We're back. Episode number 3.
I think I can. I think I can. I know I can. Let's do this.
Welcome to the Innovateology Podcast, where it is all about unleashing the creative side to find those brilliant, disruptive ideas to validate and build innovative solutions to solve life's problems.
I'm your host, Mary, and I have our co-hosts today, Linda and Melissa, on the podcast as well, too. And our agenda is looking at mindset. And this is looking at mindset of mastery of athletics, arts, mindfulness, and the way it shapes our ability to create and problem solve. So just to frame up the situation. So are you ever curious on how to like re-energize and constantly keep going and problem solve? When I was young, I actually mastered the sport of swimming, and I built my identity and confidence around this mastery of swimming. I became known as a swimmer among my peers, my other colleagues, and it's actually a skill that's kind of paid off in life. The long hours of swimming and staring at the bottom of the pool and holding it together under tough pressure for making quick decisions during a race or when to know to hold back the energy and then push it forward for that finish line sprint. It wasn't always easy sticking to a sport for most of my life. There were many times when I just wanted to get out of the pool and do something else, or I wanted to skip practice to go hang out with friends, but I kept with it and evolved it. So from a swimmer, I became a triathlete, and then it actually took me around the world. And swimming was just kind of a stepping stone to building a stronger mindset and inner strength. And then ultimately, it kind of helped me solve problems creatively because I would be able to look at a situation and say, oh, let's take baby steps to get to that goal. So some of the questions that we hope to answer on this podcast is, how can mastering another skill help you succeed in life, in business, and in your career? And also, can learning to paint or do a sport foster a mindset to solve problems? So we'll cover in this first story, and I'll start first, is from an athlete to corporate life. A coach once told me to pace yourself. And when I was working out, I would always go out and just start the run in a sprint because I was like, I'm going to just beat everybody. I'm going to completely make it to the finish line and be the fastest one there. But that's not really how you do a race. It's not really how you can do a workout. You can only sprint for so long. So you really need to focus on optimizing your energy and focus on holding a pace to get into this ideal state of performance is really what you want to try and go for in sports. If you go out too fast, then you can't survive towards the finish and finish the end of the race, or you hit a wall is what they call in cycling. And there's been many races where I actually have hit a wall and just can't keep going and actually didn't finish. But you learn from every race, just like you learn every day, to pace yourself. And this goes into competition as it gets greater. So as it gets greater, you need to work on threshold strength training and a whole gamut that goes around it to not fold under the pressure. So you're constantly putting your body under little bits of stress, which are those sprints, to get to that finer goal of holding a 5K or a 3-mile race at a certain threshold. So with this mindset of understanding what the goal was at the end, I would break down with each discipline, such as in triathlon, swim, bike, run, what my goals were for the year. I would have A races, B races, and C races, and I'd have like a micro schedule that I would focus on, and also a macro schedule. And within that, we'd have little goals and little wins. And each week, I'd have different aspects of training. And it sometimes went on a cadence of 3 weeks on, where you were slowly building up. And on that fourth week, you'd take a rest and recovery break. I'd work on different aspects of the race, such as distance training on Monday. Wednesday would be high-intensity training. And most of the people that would train with me would know I'd call it the JFT day, which has an acronym that I will not repeat on this podcast. and then I'd have sprint training Fridays. And each workout would have a purpose on what I was trying to do. And starting out, it was not always easy. It was sometimes having to change that behavior of, I can do this. I can do this. I'm in pain, but I can do this, and keeping with it because I'd ultimately thinking of that end goal that I was trying to reach.
So Mary, do you think that breaking your goals down into the micro goals that you refer to are part of what kept you motivated?
Yes. So you look at your small wins, but you also look at your big wins. So every day you not only pace yourself, but you think of what did you do that was a small win? And I think all too often we forget that we didn't do that. But also what's key is to do rest and recovery. So when we push ourselves, we've got to have that rest and recovery to recover, whether it's from sprinting and then having to in corporate life, I call it the roadmap planning. You're going to implement it, but then you got to look for that time where you're going to put together that strategy. So a lot of people ask me, how does an athlete transfer to corporate life? And how can we do this? And I say, you have to visualize your success. A lot of times what you'll see is like in the Olympics, you'll see Michael Phelps and all the swimmers. They have a room that they have behind the blocks. And what it is they put on their headset and you'll see Michael Phelps get into the zone and he's visualizing success. He's actually watching himself race over and over and over again. And all too often in corporate life, I think we don't always visualize success. We don't always think how we're going to get to that next step. A lot of times we're just focused on the day-to-day and just trying to push out that next report. Another part of it is staying positive and looking at that small win. So for instance, at the end of a day, if I could get done what was on my focus for that day, that is a small win in corporate life. And then I focus on learning from the losses. So for instance, if you had a bad day, what is something that you can learn from? And then set up small goals to reach your larger goals.
Interesting. So what would you say is the ideal state of performance?
So this is when you are thriving and not just surviving. So in sports, it's that pacing yourself, but it's also looking, and in corporate, it's looking at, you'll see some people just come in with like their cups of coffee and they're just like, I'm here and I need to crunch out another report. But sometimes you have to think of what's the value of that report? What are you trying to get from it? Where is it fitting in that overall goal that you're trying to get towards the end of the year that you can report on and show that you move the company forward? That's something that I try and do. Setting up recovery times too. So, you know, throughout the day, we're going at work nonstop. You're going from meeting to meeting. A lot of times there isn't enough time to rest and shut off the mind and kind of switch it to a recovery mode. I know that we have vacation, and a lot of times I think we don't take the vacation like we should. So I know that in the United States, we probably only get 2 weeks, and sometimes we might not even get that. But it's really important to take your vacation time and focus on recovery. Turn off that cell phone. Get away. Chronic stress will actually deplete your energy reserves, and this leads to that burnout and breakdown, and ultimately undermines our performance. And balancing your energy across all aspects of life, both physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. So for instance, spending quality time with family and being present in the moment. These are all key aspects that you can kind of learn from that athletic ideal state of performance to put into your corporate and your everyday life.
So Mary, am I understanding you that the correlation between athlete and corporate is really that we shouldn't just look at a vacation or some time away or even that break as something that's a luxury, but it's really essential?
It is essential. That's so true. I'm sure Linda and Melissa can add many times where you've been on vacation and you have a cell phone. It's really important to just turn it off and say, you know what? I'm on vacation. I earn these days. I've worked hard for the company. I know I can shut off and relax. And sometimes if you need to, you can buy vacation trip insurance, which I do. So I can even relax even more knowing that if anything ever happens, I'm covered. And so some of the action items that, you know, you can take away from is when you set an objective or a goal for the year, pace yourself. And rest and relaxation is part of that pacing yourself. Mindset is key. You got to visualize success. When you walk into that room, that conference room, know what your goals are. Know what you're going to get across. visualize it before you go in. And don't forget to always incorporate relaxed times and downtimes, even in your day or your week schedule. I know sometimes we get home from work late at night. We're driving home. We're thinking about all these things that we have to do. Sometimes that's why exercise is important throughout your day, because it's that 30 minutes where you're just going to focus on yourself, your time alone. So those are just some key action items just to learn from incorporating athletics or my mastery of athlete and to corporate life. So with that, I'm going to switch over to Melissa, who has a different expertise and mastery around painting.
All right. Thanks. So this mindset story is really about mastering or trying to be an expert into something. So lately I've been working myself on developing a mindset for success on how to become a master or an expert, as I would like to bring my own artwork up to another level and build a no-fail, like clear-cut strategic plan on how to go to novice to expert, not only for myself, but also I want to be a teacher too. So I've been studying a number of books on mastery on how to build a plan for myself, so I thought I'd share that with you. And the first thing is finding a targeted subject or aspect that you care about, which in your heart you feel other people should care about. Now, it could be like mine is painting. It could be motherhood. It could be, you know, your career, that you want to be an expert in this part of your career, or, you know, part of your business that everyone goes to because you know the most about it. So in trying to master something, you should first find that one basic fundamental skill that's so important to what you want to master. And you should practice that skill to its essence. And say in painting, it may be, you know, the brushstroke as the thing you'll focus first, or it may be a stroke in swimming like Mary, or a pose in yoga if you're looking to master yoga.
Well, Melissa, it actually sounds like you're relating to what Mary shared, because it sounds, am I hearing this correctly, that it's like micro goals?
Yeah, so this is the theory is starting with that one thing, that one basic fundamental skill, and then you're going to build on that one skill, but not till you have it really down. Like, this is doing deliberate practice, meaning going over and over and over that skill, this maybe first skill, painstaking refinement, you know, your movements, if it's yoga, or that skill to it's into your unconscious. And I think, you know, especially in art, people think, oh, you should just paint whatever. But, you know what I mean? It's expressing yourself. But it's just like music. If you don't know the keys, you don't know, and it's not ingrained into your head, you know, you don't have to be, you have to learn the technical to then let go and, you know, let it out afterwards. So, and being expressive afterwards. So basically, you immerse yourself into the basic fundamentals so that it is a point of exhaustion that they're so internalized that you don't even have to think about that stroke. You know what I mean? You have it down. And then you build on to the next fundamental, kind of like an onion. You know what I mean? You're building each fundamental till they're in like clusters or like into little blocks of knowledge. So you're almost building like a pyramid of knowledge. So you're learning this block and then the next block. You're learning the theories, the principles, the techniques, and you're trying to build it into this strategic, systematic understanding of the study.
Well, Melissa, it sounds like a lot of times people seem to think, oh, you just go with what moves you or what have you, particularly in painting.
Right.
But it sounds like you're saying that it's the way you can ultimately be the most creative and expressive and the most free is through this discipline.
I mean, all to learn, you know, to start to learn and really learn. If you look at the master painters, you know what I mean? They studied under other people for, you know, Michelangelo studied, you know, for 5 or 10 years under, that's what was common back then. You know what I mean? And that study is kind of been lost with all the internet and everything. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. you don't spend the time really studying what you're into. And kind of like Mary said, you know, going back from micro to macro, you know, studying details, but then the big picture of your painting, you know what I mean? Or the art of itself. So, like, I'm bringing up Michelangelo again, you know, he would start, most people now start paintings from the big picture, what am I going to paint? But he actually started from studying minute detail of plants, and then he would build from that, the painting from that. So you can go back and forth from micro to macro. So then you need to build a study plan, you know, like Mary said, a timeline. What are you going to do this week? You know, you have your total year planned out, and you should see it visually. Track all, you know, your key training, build a timeline, see the big picture. And then you can also find a mentor. And obviously you want to find a mentor maybe who, you know, you look up to, their work. You should go back to all the masters of whether you're music or art. And reproduce the paintings of the masters. You know, why did they do it this way? And it is real. I've done it, and it's very interesting because you see things you'd never see in the painting unless you actually painted it yourself. Mm. So just like Stephen King, you know, he wrote a book on mastering writing, and he says if you're a writer, you have to he continuously, no matter how good he is, he reads books of, you know, the past masters and or current people right now.
Well, how do you get into the mindset of trying to be a master or an expert?
And that's, you know, you have to go, and that's probably a good lead for your talk, Linda, but, you know, getting deep into activity and being present with what you're trying to learn. With all the distractions and kind of surface learning on the internet, you know, we have to be able to work deep alone by yourself and being, you know, spending 4 hours straight just doing one thing, you know, so because there's just so many distractions and throughout the day that it's harder and harder to do that. But another big thing is to embrace the struggle. Like people want to have, you know, oh, I want a pretty picture. You know what I mean? You know, you want this perfect looking thing at the end. But it's not about the result. It's about the process. It's about the struggle. And you have to feel good in that struggle, you know, standing in front of a painting or whatever you're doing. John Singer Sargent was, you know, a great artist, and he used to wipe out parts of his canvas all the time, even though, you know, it might have looked good, but it wasn't good enough. So he just enjoyed the struggle of trying to get there.
And, you know, and Melissa, that's the same for any sport. As I say, the race is the easy part. It's the right. struggle to get there, all the training that you take right. and all the beatings that you take to your body to get to that one point where you can finally race. Right. And that's so true. Another part that is interesting is that the time it takes. So the time it takes to master a skill, and I saw this on the internet a couple days ago, is that one golfer, it actually took him 10,000 hours just right. to be able to right. master a one particular part of golfing. Right. So, you know, I think all too often we tend to think that we can master, oh, we found a course online. It's going to make us an expert in this field, but a 4-hour course is not going to necessarily help you master yeah. a particular concept, especially painting and especially swimming.
Right. Right. You know, and you have to enjoy the struggle, and you have to spend a lot of deep time doing it yourself alone. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily, you know, time a group thing. But another point was bringing yourself, you know, if you are alone, like a lot of artists are alone by themselves working day after day, and it can get lonely, you know, but you have to see your part as, you know, I'm a part of this big historical, you know, life of artists, and you're not alone. They're who are doing the same thing have been for years. And then, you know, you have to believe in yourself that you can be as good and that you can master. So, you know, in big picture, one, find that one basic fundamental skill that can be translated into all the other skills. Do deliberate practice. Build a pyramid of skills, and then build yourself your own master study plan with a timeline. That's basically, you know, start thinking of something that you want to master and you want to be an expert in and go for it. So Linda's next, and she's going to talk about mindfulness.
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. And actually, I think as every time we do these podcasts, I sometimes think that it sounds as if we're coming from really different places, but the threads are so strong amongst all of the conversation that we have here. I'm speaking about mindfulness. As a corporate marketer with worldwide responsibilities, I was always living months and years ahead of the present. And my profession required frequent travel across time zones and climates, and it required forward thinking, scenario planning, and even anticipating the moves of competitors. And there were times when I would land at home for a few days and think, oh, the summer just began, because my mind was so far ahead of the future. So when I became exposed to the practice of mindfulness, it was appealing to me, but I was resistant because I wasn't completely convinced that fully focusing on the present was enough. But I think we heard from Mary and Melissa a lot about the value of really focusing on the present and committing yourself fully in the present. I guess when I thought it wasn't enough, it was a sense that it wasn't enough for flourishing in the world. But I think there's lots of cases. And again, as Mary and Melissa just shared, whether you're a painter or you're an athlete, that really to flourish in the future begins in the current moment. And so I enrolled in a formal mindfulness training.
And what were the actions that you did to get to that?
Well, actually, it was interesting because I began by just taking sporadic mindfulness classes, or I should say attending groups. I wouldn't say they were classes per se. But to the point that you made a minute ago, I really wasn't committed. And so it wasn't until I joined a class that I came to fully appreciate the practice. Because mindfulness isn't just meditation. It's not, you know, oh, let's get away for an hour or two, retreat from it all, let's escape like a spa day. It's really a practice and a discipline. Some people would kind of cringe with saying discipline with mindfulness because they don't like to attach something that sounds rigid. But the truth is that to really experience mindfulness, it is something that you need to be completely committed to. And it is about getting all in, not getting away. And I think that's what became more appealing to me. It wasn't about moving away from the world that there is, but really participating more fully in it. A lot of times in mindfulness, you hear it's about being fully aware now. And how that was made real for me was I recalled that when I was in corporate, and we talked a lot about employee productivity, and it was really important for employers that they had present employees. So we use the term presenteeism. Employers want employees who are not merely physically present, but mindfully present. They want employees to be fully engaged in the task at hand. And if you think about it, mindful employees do what's necessary to perform their role to the best of their ability in the moment. If you're really mindful, you're awake to your environment around you. So just again, harkening back to the previous two discussions, they spoke about the environment around them and being really in tune to it. So that's what it's really about, mindfulness. And so if you really are awake to your environment, then you make decisions in full consciousness of the factors that are present. And so you make better decisions. Yeah.
So an example, Linda, that I'm thinking of is all too often we're in a meeting and you see everybody pull out their smartphone. And instead of focusing on the topic, they're focusing on their smartphone, their computer that's going off with all the emails. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the meeting is not as productive, because why were you invited to that meeting? What value were you going to offer to that
meeting?
Yeah.
And actually, Mary, to that point, I think it was just a couple years ago that a study proved that multitasking is really a myth, because we so often think, well, we're just going to, you know, look at our email or send a couple texts while we're certainly listening to the discussion in a meeting. And what's been proven is if you are not fully present in that meeting, it's not going to be effective. So there's a great cost to that if you think about the time of all the people who participate in a business meeting. So I think that it's useful to know that mindfulness practitioners don't actually walk around with their minds in clouds or in some blissful, dreamy place, but really they're fully here and they're fully engaged persons. When you're in a mindfulness practice, you live in the now with the benefit of all the knowledge and information that's available and present awareness. And when you start the practice, and I'll give some tips on that, it's really you slowly peel away that onion and understand how not awake you typically move through your days. So, and how often we tend to think about things going on in our past and our future, and how really distracted we can become thinking about the past and the future. And that kind of, it's like a snowball. We think more about these things, we become less aware of the moment, and it ultimately affects our performance.
So, Linda, are you doing that? So throughout the day, you're thinking about being in the present moment, but are you also doing like where, you know, you're sitting there for a half an hour in mindfulness, or what do you do?
Yeah, well, actually, it's a great question, Melissa, and it's not all that different from being an athlete or a painter, because you still need the daily formal practice. So it really should be to be able to have it become something that you do unconsciously. That it takes the same sort of conditioning. So it really does require commitment to say that at whatever time is best for you. And for me, it's usually in the morning when I do the formal practice, and the practice really becomes, you know, really becoming aware of just the moment and what's around you, which may sound silly until you start actually practicing it and you become aware of how much you're missing every day. So this daily awareness begins. Really, the first steps in any class is to just think about your breathing, and just start with doing that and allowing, you know, perhaps some distractions to cross your path. And as these distracting thoughts happen, let them happen, but bringing yourself always back to the present. And if you keep doing that, and certainly there's much more to the discipline or practice of mindfulness, but when you keep doing it, it becomes that sort of second nature unconscious skill, so that you become much more alert and mindfulness trained folks say awake in the moment. Yeah.
I've been doing that with my dishwasher broke, so I've been washing my own dishes, and so I've been trying to do that, like washing my dish, really not thinking about anything else but what I'm doing at that moment, washing the dishes, or when I'm driving the car, I'm not thinking of 100 things, like feeling the wheels underneath your car. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and actually, you know, I've even started applying it even when, let's say, I'm at the sink washing off a piece of fruit to eat. And a lot of times people are encouraged to begin a practice with even thinking about their eating, because so many times we're in such a frenetic pace, we don't even stop a moment to think about the eating that we're doing. And when you do, and you start to really taste it and think about it and savor it, one, you enjoy the food much more, but two, it's been proven through studies that actually you tend to eat less, because you're not just kind of mindlessly eating. So you're absolutely right, Melissa. There's so many different things we do during the day that just can be a richer experience if our minds are fully there. So the benefits of mindfulness, application for mindfulness is stress relief, because I was not quite sure how this would apply when I first learned about it. But what I found from people who have taken the mindfulness practice to heart as it concerns chronic illness, for instance, is they found that it really helps them with coping and moving through their experience of whatever chronic condition they have. It also helps with stress in my experience of it, because as you become immersed in the practice of it, then the part of the practice is allowing yourself to acknowledge, you know, the stress is happening. How are you feeling? How are you moving through it? But not allowing it to kind of build and kind of snowball in some conditioned cascade that may be unproductive. So the whole spirit of this is to help you become more fully awake in your everyday life and to live a more deliberate life. But what's a really interesting result that happens, and maybe it's something that's at the essence of us as humans, but there's something that comes through that we become kinder people when we practice, and we also get this great ability to appreciate kindness and humanity around us. So it's got a lot of really wonderful benefits, and I think it's really harmonious with any mastery, whether it's becoming an athlete or a painter.
So Linda, do you feel like you can relate better to others after taking mindfulness classes or just practicing it on a daily basis?
I do, because I think that the more I appreciate my own humanness and vulnerabilities and foibles, as well as, you know, one thing they teach too is to be gentle with yourself and to be caring with yourself. And actually, I think the more you take that to heart and become caring of yourself, I really do think it spills over to how you become caring for other people.
Interesting.
So in terms of like a daily time commitment, I do think it's worth setting aside, you know, some 40 minutes or so in a day to really work on this. As Melissa used the term, I think you said deep time. So taking time where it's not just for skimming through, but really allow yourself that deep time.
So do you do 40 minutes at one time, or do you break it up in chunks throughout the day?
Well, I tend to do it both ways. Sometimes it's a 20-minute meditation, they can call it, although it's, for me, it doesn't seem quite like the classic meditation. But and then sporadically throughout the day, just some of the practices. So in a class, you actually learn some tools that you can run through to kind of help you get, you know, return to, you know, remind yourself about returning to awareness during the day.
So can you give like an example of a daily routine and where you're incorporating mindfulness throughout your day? So for instance, sure. You just said that you woke up, and before, I know you're probably laying in bed. What's that first thing that you do?
Well, the first thing is really about like the being mindful of your breath, because that's the most accessible to everybody. That as you concentrate on just the breathing in and out, and it doesn't have to be deep breathing or anything, but just focusing on that breath and then kind of allowing your awareness to build to be perhaps beyond the breath to what are you hearing, then what are you seeing, and then just what's sharing the moment with you. And then that kind of gets you into that moment. And I could share an example that's probably a great universal example of how we can be mindful and mindless. Usually a great way to catch yourself is when you're driving, because it happens to me probably on a daily basis when I'm driving, and I'll feel really enraged about somebody who did something on the road. And then I catch myself in that feeling of it, because, you know, perhaps there was somebody who didn't put on a turn signal, or that, you know, got in front of me when it was probably not the safest move. And sometimes we can feel it like it's a threat to ourselves, and appropriately we brake or do whatever we need to in the car. But if we think about the emotion attached to it, sometimes it reverberates way longer than it needs to. And sometimes when you hear about road rage, it's really people who become further and further away from being aware. Because if you really are aware, you don't allow your emotions to just escalate to the point where, you know, there's something really silly that happens between confrontations with folks, because you're able to kind of say, okay, here's how I'm feeling, here's what happened. And I guess you take it in a more balanced and appropriate way, instead of blowing it out of proportion.
So that's some interesting items that we can all learn from, of how to kind of incorporate mindfulness. I've sure learned a lot, and I know we're coming up close on our time for those that are driving into work, or those that are listening to us. So just some action items to wrap up from each of our items that we learned today around mastery. Is from an athlete to corporate life, you know, pace yourself, and rest and relaxation is key, and also visualizing that success. From Melissa, do you want to sum up what we learned from being a painter?
Yeah, is building and taking time to figure out your master plan of how you're going to master and be an expert at something, starting at the fundamentals, and then moving forward into bigger chunks, and getting deep inside and being present for those learning periods.
And also knowing that it's not going to happen overnight. We can't right. become a painter overnight. Unfortunately, all those major artists that we all know and we see in the Louvre and d'Orsay all didn't become artists overnight. They were probably unknown, and it took many times of getting in front of the right people and painting. And the Monet's lilies have changed many times, and if you ever walk into d'Orsay, you'll see happy, sad, different colors, different lights, that there's not, it doesn't happen overnight. Yeah. And with Linda, we learned more around being mindful and mindfulness and stopping in that moment to take a breath. I think in corporate, this is critical, and that we should probably take this into heart a lot more, because turning off that cell phone and focusing on that meeting about the value that you're going to bring is critical. And Linda, do you want to sum up?
Sure. So much like you and Melissa alluded to, that I think in the end, daily formal practice is really worth it, because pretty much any goal you have is going to be something that's not just something off in the distance. It's something that happens as a result of what you do now.
So that wraps up our podcast about mindset. So thank you, everybody, for listening to us. We love feedback. So please leave us a comment on our website or on iTunes, and hopefully we'll be able to answer some of your questions that you will post. Until next time, keep innovating. All right, that's a wrap. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for listening to the Innovateology Podcast. We hope we have generated some disruptive ideas and helped unleash that creative side. Please help us keep innovating and leave us a comment or a review on our website. Till next time, don't stop innovating.